Welcome to the Bill Barnwell Show. I'm Bill Barnwell of ESPN. Last week at Munich Times, we covered the NFC, went over those off-season grades, and, well, as you might suspect, today we are going to go over the AFC grades, go team by team, and joining me to do that, strangely, someone I assumed I must have had on in the past, but it turns out I have not, a first-time guest on the show. It's someone I've known for quite a long time now. It's TV, Fantasy Focus, all over ESPN. A star of stage and sound, Field Yates, is on the show today. Fields, how are you?
Bill, I'm doing well, although I'm a little bit nervous. And I'm not going to lie to you. Munich Kimes, so going from Munich Kimes previewing, or I guess recapping one conference, to me recapping the other, I'm trying to think of the appropriate football analogy. Like, what was a really clumsily handled quarterback transition? I got it. Munich Kimes is Dan Marino. I'm every Dolphins quarterback since then. So whether you want to call me Ryan Tannehill, Jay Cutler, Jay Fiedler, I would take Brian Greasy, like you name it. Ty Detmer was there for hints for like a cup of coffee. Whichever one you want, that is me, America.
We could just name Dolphins quarterbacks for the entire show. I'm fine with that.
I'm not sure we have enough time in the day to do that.
Well, do you want to start with the AFC East? It seems like a logical place to go, given that you just brought up the Dolphins.
I was going to say, weirdly enough, whenever I write 32 team pieces on ESPN.com, which I do like maybe like a handful of times a year, each year, I always start in the East. I don't know why. I don't know why that is, like, almost, even though it's not chronological, there's no such thing as chronological when you're listing teams by location. If such a thing existed, that would be how I would chronologically list them.
It just seems right, even though...
East Coast bias.
Right, that's what it must be. There's only one explanation for that. It's East Coast bias. We want Alabama to get into the playoff. LeBron James, I don't know. You know the ESPN rules, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty much... We are checking them all off right now. Let's do it.
We have a meeting every year, and we're just like, what are we going to figure out this year?
Yep.
I agree with you, though. I start in the East as well, and it could be that the fact that the most likely the best team in the AFC happens to be in the AFC East.
Yes.
And the Miami Dolphins, I think we all agree, are the best team in football this year. I don't see what we even have to podcast about when it comes to that. But
I mean, listen, podcast, why even have the season?
Why even have the season? That's talking like a true Miami Dolphins fan, Field. And I feel like we should do it anyway, just in case, just because there's fans of other teams out there. But let's start with the Miami Dolphins. We talked about them so much, and I think they're really interesting. I don't know that I agree with the logic in what they've done, but it seems like they've pretty clearly put an emphasis on improving their team's culture.
I would say so, Bill. And let me start, if you don't mind, just for 1 minute and just sort of note that when I'm evaluating or recapping a team's offseason and specifically free agency in the draft, you and I are lucky, or at least I'm lucky, I don't have to hand out grades. You actually do have to hand out grades. Your grades basically every notable move made during the offseason. Mm-hmm. So for me, if I were to be challenged with grading moves, I feel as though I always grade by the process behind the moves, not so much the eventual outcome of the moves. There are going to be moves that I dislike this year that work out great. There are going to be moves that I like this year that turn out to be fool's gold. So I evaluate the process and I evaluate a team's plan and trajectory. So for the Dolphins, I will just say this. You are absolutely right that the emphasis has been on culture. Mm-hmm. That being said, from a talent construction standpoint, I don't have a feel for where the Dolphins believe themselves to be. Right. We'll get to the Colts later on, a team that we think knows where they are right now. They're not going to be very good. You have other teams, like, for example, the Philadelphia Eagles, that are at the mountaintop. So why not continue to add a couple of layers of depth while it's still cap-friendly, like they did this offseason? What do the Dolphins do? Do they try to get better? Do they try to get worse? Because if you're talking about building the culture up, they handed a lot of money out to players that I would say they are completely overemphasizing the value of culture if that's the reason that you're going to give someone like Danny Amendola $6 million or pay for and absorb the Robert Quinn contract after moving on from a guy like Ndamukong Suh. I like each of those players. I respect them both immensely. I spent some time and know Danny Amendola. There's nothing wrong with him as a player or as a person. He's exemplary as a teammate, but $6 million per season is a lot of money to spend on a guy that we have emphasis. We have empirical evidence, I should say, that he's probably at his best when he's playing between 40 and 50% of your offensive snaps. If you're paying $6 million to a wide receiver, you probably want him on the field minimum 85 to 90% of the plays.
Yeah, and that's not even the most expensive wide receiver they added this offseason.
It is not. I mean, Albert Wilson for $8 million a year, and I've looked a little bit closer at the contract, and I think in essence it's a one-year deal worth $8 million that they can revisit next offseason. But still, it would be one thing if there was a Packers wide receiver or a Steelers wide receiver who, or a Patriots wide receiver for that matter, who we weren't that aware of, who signed a big contract, and you say, well, they've got so many good players on their offense at that position that I can kind of see that guy having been buried. Like if it was the fourth Steelers wide receiver and you're like, yeah, well, Antonio Brown, Juju Smith-Schuster, Martavis Bryant to a degree. The Chiefs had a critical flaw last year. Not enough reliable passing game targets. At the end of the season, we saw that. And yet Albert Wilson gets $8 million per season. He was not a massive factor for the Kansas City Chiefs. I don't know how all of a sudden he becomes a massive factor for the Miami Dolphins other than the fact that he's getting paid $8 million this year.
Yeah, and I think the tough part is that you look at the moves they made and you say, okay, well, they want to invest in wide receivers. I don't necessarily agree with the moves they made, but that's fine. That's a plan. That's a reasonable thing to do. There are holes elsewhere on their roster, but that's what they want to do. That's fine. You can't come out a month after the draft and say, yeah, you know, it's really important to us to be multiple on offense. We want to come out with a lot of three tight end sets. We want to play 13 personnel on offense, which is what offensive coordinator, I think it was Dowell Loggins actually, not the offensive coordinator, but Dowell Loggins, I believe, said that, about the Dolphins. And that's like, it just doesn't really seem to add up given the personnel decisions they made. So it just seems like, they are going from plan to plan on a week to week basis. And it's tough to win that way. And when you talk about the Dolphins and their culture, well, this is a team last year that traded Jay Ajayi in midseason with allusions to that he was hurting the team culture. And, you know, you saw it wasn't really a problem in Philadelphia. He seemed to work out fine there.
He sure did. And it felt like, I don't know if like sacrificial lamb is quite the appropriate term, but it's the only thing I can think of right now to describe the Jay Ajayi trade. And it would be one thing if the Jay Ajayi trade was a pivot point in the season. Like that was the lever for Miami and all of a sudden things got decidedly better. You can make the case that they found a more than capable replacement in Kenyon Drake.
I do, yeah.
And yet this offseason, of course, they go and they sign Frank Gore to a one-year deal. They draft, I believe it was a fourth round pick for Caitlin Ballage. Is that correct? Yeah. So it's like, you know, they've made other investments that suggest they're still not entirely sold on Kenyon Barner. So again, I'm with you. You said week to week for the Dolphins. It feels like, you know, just from evaluating the roster, sometimes it's year to year, the plan changes. And I just don't know that in the NFL where the goal is sustained success, it can sustain unless you actually stick to it for more than like 18 months at a time.
Yeah, I think it's true. And I don't dislike some of the moves they made. I think drafting Minkah Fitzpatrick as the best player available on their board, even though they had invested a bunch at safety, I don't mind that. I mean, in the NFL right now, when you have so many teams that want to come out with, you know, hybrid personnel and offense, Minkah Fitzpatrick's such a valuable, useful player that I can't fault them for taking him. And I think that drafting Mike Gesicki was a guy they needed in the second round. That's a position of need for them at tight end. So I can't fault some of their moves, but I just, the overall cap management, the overall valuation process they have on players, it doesn't seem to add up to a consistent sort of view, like you said, of where they are sort of in this success cycle.
Completely agree. It's been a, so we are starting off on a strong tone here. But this may be as harsh as we are on any team throughout the rest of, throughout the AFC. I just have a very difficult time making sense of where the Dolphins are.
So I'm going to give them a D+. That's my grade for them for this offseason. Do you want to give a grade? You don't have to. You're the guest.
I'll give them a D for this offseason.
A D?
Yeah. And I know, and I'm sure that, you know, Dolphins fans will come out hard against us, but that's okay. Like, this is going to be probably the worst grade we hand out this offseason. My process here at ESPN, for those who may not know, I used to work on, you know, in scouting in the NFL. I had my cups of coffee there. And like what I tell people is I understand that we are going to see moves made right away that we don't understand. But I always try to figure them out from the team side. And I'm having a hard time figuring out from the team side some of the moves Miami made.
Yeah. So now when it comes to the Buffalo Bills, for example, I have my hangups about Josh Allen. I would say, in my opinion, based on the numbers, he is a player who history says is more likely to fail than succeed. Now, however, I also wrote a column for ESPN saying I don't think we know a lot about quarterbacks. And when it comes to evaluating the Bills offseason, it's way too early to evaluate Josh Allen. So I can't evaluate him and say, okay, well, I think Josh Allen's going to stink, so they had a bad offseason. But what does confuse me is that when it comes to the Bills, if you have a guy like Josh Allen and you have a young quarterback who you want to develop, you need to put pieces around him. You can't expect him to do it by himself. And I look at the Bills depth chart on offense, and how they've sort of changed over the past couple of years. I don't know that any quarterback has less to work with when it comes to his offensive line and with his receiving core than Josh Allen's going to have this year in Buffalo.
So let's just press fast forward in life and get to early June of 2019 when this is being released. My apologies. And we're probably going to be saying that, you know, last year we're talking about Jared Goff and whether his rookie season could potentially have been a crippling impact on his career. Mm-hmm. This year it's Mitch Trubisky. Next year it could be Josh Allen, because we don't know that he'll play much this year in Buffalo, but recent history suggests that every rookie quarterback is going to play a lot and probably sooner than teams intend them to. But you're right, Bill. Josh Allen, wherever you are and as a prospect, is a separate conversation from the fact that who is the Bills' second best wide receiver? Who is it?
Boy. It's Zay Jones is hurt, so
right. Yep.
We're looking at Jeremy Curley, maybe?
Probably Jeremy Curley. I mean, well, at least in terms of the largest sample size of him being successful in the NFL, he'd be number two. But again, Jeremy Curley was out of work for a long time this offseason. Mm-hmm. So I just don't understand exactly how Josh Allen has success unless it's with a dominant offensive line and running game. The running game can be good, but this is a team that lost two offensive linemen to retirement. And I understand they traded away Cordy Glenn, but Deion Dawkins had kind of immersed himself as their left tackle, as it were, late last season. But still, two offensive linemen gone to retirement, not a lot of pass catchers. It's going to be difficult for the Bills to immediately find success with Josh Allen under center. This is a separate conversation for what I think about him as a prospect. Mm-hmm. That being said, Bill, I actually am okay with a lot of how the Bills have handled the process, and that's a term that we know, obviously, infamous through the 76ers, but like Brandon Bean and Sean McDermott are very much in on the process as well. So I'm okay with the idea that like the patient rebuild is better than, you know, putting the band-aids on a couple of roster wounds this offseason and hoping that 9-7 last year replicates itself and once again you make it to the playoffs. But just because you broke a streak of whatever it was, 22 years without getting to the postseason, that should not be justification enough as to like, yep, we're good. Like we bought ourselves 5 years of job security. No, the reality is in the NFL, like it's making a deep run that keeps you around. So I'm okay with the Bills. I'm a fan of how the Bills have largely approached the past couple of years from a roster building standpoint.
I am too. And I think overall, most of the moves have been good. And I think even with this offseason, you know, on the defensive side of the ball, I like Starwell Tulele. I think he's a very solid run-stuffing defensive tackle. Trent Murphy is someone who, when he's been healthy and not injured or suspended, has been a pretty useful pass rusher. Vontae Davis was someone who was a Pro Bowl cornerback as recently as a couple of years ago. And a lot of the moves they made in the secondary last year panned out. So I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt in terms of the moves they made in the secondary. So I can't fault them for a lot of the stuff they did, but I do think you have to... Even if you're not going to plan on trying to win this year, I think you need to do more for your young quarterback if you know you're taking a quarterback. And once they moved on from Tyrod Taylor, it kind of was pretty clear they were going to take a quarterback. So I do think it would have been nice to see them go into free agency and grab an offensive lineman who is better than Russell Bodine at center. Because even if you think it's not about 2018, you want a guy who's going to be protecting your own quarterback for years to come. And if you sign the right guy, he's going to be there for 4 or 5 years on the offensive line. So I would have liked to see more investment there, as opposed to, you know, even going out and getting a wide receiver or getting, you know, another tight end. I feel like that would have been the sort of logical move for them.
No team likes to retain players more that they acquired on their own than the Bengals. That's just the truth. Yeah. The Packers are up there, but the Bengals love nothing more than to draft a guy, keep him around for 8 to 10 years, even if he's just an above average player. That's what they do. Russell Bodine, as you mentioned, he started every game for them over the past 4 years at center. You'd think, like, hey, he must be okay, right? He's average. And if the Bengals are comfortable letting him walk, and I understand they upgraded with Billy Price in the first round, that probably tells you about where he is valued league-wide as a player. So I'm with you on the Bills. So if I had to pick a grade, if we were to hand out the hardware, so to speak.
Yes.
I think I'd go C+ for the Bills, only because obviously there is a talent dearth in Buffalo on the offensive side of the ball. But I'm good with the process, so I'm not going to, you know, I don't want to say, like, obviously they've lost a lot of pieces this year, but I can't be entirely down on this offseason and say, because I do agree with where they are going in the future.
Yep, I would say a C. Again, I'm leaving my Allen opinion out. I just think no matter who the quarterback is, I think they're going to need more infrastructure for him. And, you know, maybe they make another addition in the next few weeks. Not out of the question. There's still some guys out there who could maybe help a team in the right spot, but I do want to see them add more. I think that's going to be, you know, sort of what they have to do next offseason, regardless of what happens this year, is really add some investment for Josh Allen to work with. New England Patriots don't really need to add a lot every single year, but this was an offseason where they did lose a bunch of talent, where, you know, they're going to lose a guy or two every year, but this year, Brandon Cooks, Danny Amendola, Nate Solder, Deion Lewis, Malcolm Butler, I mean, a bunch of guys who were either top-level players or meaningful role contributors for them on both sides of the football. So do you think it's, you know, something that the Patriots really were able to account for and make additions to replace those guys?
Yeah, I think so, Bill, and it's one of those weird ones where if you took it in the composite, people would be like, oh my, you just listen to those things. They failed the offseason, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then you dig a little bit deeper. And we said at the beginning of this, like, you have to make these decisions based off of the process involved. So if I told you Nate Solder could become the highest paid offensive lineman in NFL history, would you make that move, yes or no? Like, in a vacuum, I think the answer is probably no, right? And pretty clearly no. We just said we didn't think that, you know, paying Danny Amendola $6 million a year was smart business by the Dolphins. So it would have in turn made it poor business by the Patriots as well. So I think that each one of those players essentially got priced out of New England based off of where teams were willing to go to on the open market. So I don't look at what the Patriots did in free agency and say that was poor management by of the roster. And last year they traded, I believe it was a 32nd pick and 103 or somewhere around there for Brandon Cooks and 1 year of around $1.5 million in salary. And a year later they flip it for the 23rd overall pick in the draft. Mm-hmm. Like, again, I understand Brandon Cooks is a very, very good player, but he's about to make $8 million this season and will want an extension around $14 or $15 million beyond that.
Yep.
So again, I think we're like, that's a pretty smart move, right? So it's one of those weird off seasons that, like, in totality, is the roster as good today as it was at the end of last year when they played in the Super Bowl? Maybe, maybe not, but I don't have a major qualm with a lot of those notable decisions.
Yeah, and I think if they were not going to go out and match those offers for those high-priced guys, and I don't think they necessarily should have in agreement with you, I think the moves they made to kind of counteract that made a lot of sense. You know, they weren't going to sign Malcolm Butler after spending so much on Stephon Gilmore, but they traded for Jason McCourty at a relatively low cost. They needed to upgrade the defensive line. That was an issue for them last year. They signed Adrian Claiborne relatively cheap, traded for Danny Shelton, a very underrated run-stuffing defensive tackle. On the offensive line, you're not going to have Nate Solder. Well, you draft Isaiah Wynn in the first round. Maybe he's an option at left tackle. Maybe Marcus Cannon moves over there eventually. You trade for Trent Brown, who was a very underrated right tackle for the Niners, who was a massive, massive player. So you left yourself with options. And I think what we've seen with the Patriots is that, you know, this is a team that is very comfortable, you know, moving on from players. They're very comfortable with developing young talent. And you have to figure that a couple of the young guys in this roster are going to improve, just like Trey Flowers has in the past when they've needed him to step up, or, you know, guys on both sides of the football. That's what the Patriots do better than anyone else, it seems like.
You know, it's funny, Bill, and sometimes I've worked there and people know that I have deep ties to that organization. So, you know, they just assume that it's like, hey, like what you're saying about the Patriots, you're just like trying to carry water. And I'm like, listen, there's an ability to be like very familiar with an organization and still speak objectively about them.
Of course.
The Patriots, like, the other thing people do is, like, people want to make the Patriots success solely about something like Bill Belichick and Tom Brady's existence, which I understand that they are probably the best ever at their respective jobs, and yet they still do a lot of things better than almost any other team in the NFL, including player development and also including, like, I guess, like, player restocking, right? Mm-hmm. Objectively, again, in a vacuum, who was a better player last year, Jason McCourty or Malcolm Butler? The answer is pretty clearly Jason McCourty. And if you could have one for $2.5 million or the other for, I believe it was 6 years and 51 million, I'm sorry, 5 years and $61 million, good football sense would lead you to pick Jason McCourty. So I think that this offseason, while I'm not saying that the roster is demonstrably better, like, I'm okay with a lot of the process here.
Right. Also, the Patriots, pretty objectively good. Like, I feel like if you're going to, like, if you were like sitting here and saying, hey, the Browns, phenomenal team, no flaws, 14-2 this year, I'd be like, well, I don't know if I trust that, but the Patriots are pretty good.
Yeah.
Like, I think it's reasonable to think they're going to be good again this year. I'd give them a B. You know, I do think that You maybe would have hoped for them to not take a running back in the first round. That surprised me a little bit, I have to admit. I think Sony Michel is going to be good, but just they've been so good at finding running backs relatively cheap that I would have liked to see them maybe go in a different direction. And I think maybe a little bit more pass rush help. It would have been nice.
Bill's going to say B for me as well. And the two areas that I still think are major needs for the Patriots are pass rushers and stand-up linebackers, guys who can play sideline to sideline. I'm just not sure that they, those were areas that were exposed in the Super Bowl. I'm not sure that either area is decidedly better as of this moment.
Mm-hmm. New York Jets, team in transition, finally found their quarterback, though. Drafted Sam Darnold with the 3rd overall pick. Traded up multiple second-round picks, traded away in the process. Obviously, still some time to work with. We're going to see what happens with Sam Darnold. But outside of the Darnold pick, what do you think about what the Jets have done to transform their roster this offseason?
Here's what I would say about quarterbacks, is that my opinion is the more darts throws you get, the more likely you are to eventually land on the bullseye, right?
Yep.
So I have no issue with the money the Jets paid this offseason, understanding that probably somebody is going to either get cut or not be on the roster week one through a trade.
Right.
This is sort of the Eagles model a couple of years ago. Now, what the Eagles did was obviously the grand slam, right? I mean, you sign Sam Bradford and Carson Wentz, you draft, plus you sign Chase Daniel, who eventually parlay that into Sam Bradford for a first-round pick. I'm not saying it's going to happen with the Jets. It almost assuredly will not happen, but... Mm-hmm. I'd rather give Teddy Bridgewater only $500,000 guaranteed, but the opportunity to make, I think it's $15 million with incentives this year, which look very unattainable based off the information that I have right now. Like, we're talking about him, you know, leading them to the playoffs, winning the Super Bowl, and being the MVP or something, you know, unlikely.
Right.
But still, the Jets gave themselves three separate avenues to finding a starting quarterback for at some point this season between Josh McCown, the incumbent, Teddy Bridgewater, and of course, Sam Darnold. So I like that idea by the Jets. Now, there are some major roster holes here. I don't know which Jets wide receiver is a sure thing to be an every down player for them beyond 2018. Obviously the offensive line leaves something to be desired.
Yep.
And I still think on defense, they're probably a pass rusher or so away. But, from a quarterback plan standpoint, I'm largely on board with what they did.
Yeah, I don't fault them. And they're not like, you know, if they had gone out and signed Sammy Watkins for $18 million a year, it would have helped their quarterback. It would have given him a number one receiver. But I don't know if that's really a great use of your resources at this point. I'd rather roll that money over, see what you have with the receivers you do have, who a lot of guys who could work out there in terms of Robbie Anderson, Quincy Enunwa, Terrell Pryor. I mean, these are guys who, you know, if things break right, could be useful, meaningful wide receivers in the NFL level. But, I don't know at this point. I think you have to kind of wait and see. And the defense, I mean, they've made additions to the defense over the past couple of years. The safeties they drafted last year look very sound. They signed Tremaine Johnson, who was a legitimate number one cornerback at this level in the NFL, who's going to make things a lot easier. Avery Williamson is going to be a run-thumping linebacker. And maybe you say, okay, they paid those guys a little more than you would have hoped for. But I think Todd Bowles is a pretty qualified defensive coach. I think he's going to get a lot out of the guys he does have to work with.
I feel like he did, like, on both sides of the ball last year that showed up for the Jets. And, again, going back to the process, like, I'm with you. I think that the only move that I have a hard time, I would say, maybe justifying would be the Tremaine Johnson contract. It was going to be really expensive by somebody, so there wasn't any gray area. Like, it's not like someone was going to say, like, hey, we just got Tremaine Johnson for 3 years and $33 million. No, it was going to be 5 years and probably north of $60 million with plenty of guaranteed money. Yeah. I just didn't know that was the kind of money I'd be wanting to spend on a cornerback, only because I think he is a bit scheme specific. Like, I don't think that Tremaine Johnson's the same player that a Patrick Peterson is, and obviously comparing someone to Patrick Peterson is largely, you know, that's sort of chasing a ghost, right? Mm-hmm. But even other cornerbacks, Marcus Peters that was acquired this offseason in a trade, guys that were traded this offseason, I think have a bit more scheme versatility, but the Jets had major talent woes, and I'm not saying that it's always good business to spend all the money you have available. More on that later on in the show. But the Jets had plenty of money to spend, and so they have built themselves a bit of margin for error.
Yeah, I think that's fair. What grade would you give them for the offseason?
I'll give them a B- in total for the New York Jets.
Interesting. I said C+, but I feel like I was more confident in them than you were.
You're getting generous. Or I'm getting generous.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, I don't know how that works. I have very high grades for the AFC North, though, I have to say. I feel like I may be very positive about the AFC North here. And Baltimore Ravens will start there. Obviously, the big concern has been getting weapons for Joe Flacco. Turns out they got weapons for Joe Flacco, and they got a replacement for Joe Flacco in the draft as well, possibly.
I mean, Joe, like, the writing's on the wall here. Talk about, like, early storylines for 2019, right? We like you a lot, but you're probably gone in a year. Yeah, I'll be honest. So a tad confusing offseason for me in this regard here is I think that Ozzie Newsome, you know, people, I feel like people don't even necessarily know that, like, he's literally one of the greatest players in NFL history. He's a Hall of Fame player, played tight end, you know, played at Alabama and then had a great story in NFL career, but has really earned his accolades as one of the best GMs in football. Right. But drafting has kind of undone the Ravens roster over the past few years. They just have not hit on first round picks with enough frequency, which is really, in some ways, can be the backbone of your roster. Mm-hmm. So they've had to do a lot of, you know, free agency band-aids. And that was kind of where they were again this offseason, right? I mean, Michael Crabtree becomes available and all of a sudden the Ravens pounce. I like Crabtree a lot, but it speaks to just how poor their wide receiver group was that they had such, you know, they had to sign him right away. I mean, like one of those deals where you bring him in and you make sure he doesn't leave the building until the contract has been executed.
Right.
So the Ravens are going to be really good on defense again next year. But on offense, like, I just don't know that I look at them and I say, you know something? I know exactly how they're going to be better this year compared to where they were last season.
Mm-hmm. Only thing I can think of, the only reason I would say they might be better is that the offensive line is going to be healthier than perhaps than it was a year ago. This was a team that I think by week three was down to their fourth string or their fourth option at guard. And unless Marshall Yonda was one of the best guards in football for most of the season. And granted, you know, at the same time, look at that offensive line, and, well, they had Ryan Jensen, who they sort of started at center as a last resort when John Russell retired, and suddenly he looked like one of the best centers in football for part of the year, signed a big deal with the Buccaneers, now center's a question mark again. So I have faith that they're going to get something done on offense, but it seems like the Flacco thing is going to kind of hang over their heads until that switch actually happens at some point during the season.
You know, Flacco, obviously, his ability, his status as a player has become a very fun for Twitter debate, thanks to our buddy PFT Commenter. Mm-hmm. But truly, like, you know, in some ways, is there a quarterback who a team has more financially invested in that is truly just about average, Bill? I mean,
that's the problem. And I don't, you know, you've kind of waited and said, okay, well, we saw what he could do in that playoff run, and well, you know, you had an excuse this year or that year, or the receivers were bad. The offensive line wasn't great. And it's like, yeah, but after 4 years of him being, you know, below average to average, it's kind of just what he is at this point.
It's really unfair to take away a player's best stretch of play in his career, right? Like, it's somewhat of a futile exercise. But if you'll bear with me for a minute and take away that Super Bowl run by the Ravens, Joe Flacco was drafted, I believe, in 2008, same year as Matt Ryan.
That's correct, yep.
Like, whose body of work is there a distinguished body of work between, if you take away that Flacco Super Bowl run between Joe Flacco, Andy Dalton, Ryan Tannehill, like, I don't know if there is, you know, like, I'm sure Ravens fans and Dolphins fans and Bengals fans would all argue it's their own quarterback, but like, I don't think that any one of them is like leaps and bounds better over year than the other. And yet, I think Joe Flacco's going to count for like $40 million against the cap this year. An incredible number when the cap is set at like 178 or whatever, or 187. Just a lot of money. So I think that Joe Flacco, again, we know he'll probably be gone, or he could well be gone next offseason, but for now, makes things difficult, to build the rest of the roster.
So, what grade would you give the Ravens for what they did in terms of adding help for Flacco or help for Lamar Jackson and adding Lamar Jackson altogether, actually?
I'll go C+ for the Ravens this offseason. Again, they're very tight to the cap, so they've had to do some managing, some finagling with players, but I'll go C+ in total for the Ravens here.
Mm-hmm. I'll go B. I like getting Lamar Jackson. I think the price they got him at, you know, late first round, I think was very solid. And they had a lot of weapons. You know, Michael Crabtree, Willie Snead, John Brown, then two tight ends in the first three rounds with Hayden Hurst and Mark Andrews. The possibility that the offense improves this year, and I think that has to be a little promising.
Fair enough.
Cincinnati Bengals, team that you mentioned a moment ago, maybe the worst offensive line in football last year. Certainly one of them.
Yep.
And look at what they did this offseason. Well, they traded for Cordy Glenn from Buffalo, who was a pretty good offensive tackle as recently as 2016. Injuries last year really hurt him when he was on the field. Draft Billy Price in the first round. Seems that's a pretty promising start to improving that offensive line.
Yeah, I think that the Cordy Glenn move might be one of those that like looks really, really good in retrospect. simply because, like, the price paid was 9 slots in the draft. And I understand that, like, that can be, it's obviously a lot in the first round. But still, like, you're not, you don't just find all left tackles just, like, floating around, right? I mean, it was a major area of concern this off, this year in terms of the draft. Like, this was not a very good draft class for offensive tackles. And then if you look at the money, like, again, Nate Solder at $15.5 million per season, and you are worth what people are willing to pay you, right? So I'm not, it's not like it. But, like, I think that Cordy Glenn's contract is a bit more palatable going forward for a team in the Bengals that rarely likes to dip its toe into free agency or even exterior players. Like, they just draft and develop. They are a unique organization. I won't bog people down with all the details of what makes them unique, but we're talking about, like, a teeny, tiny scouting staff relative to everybody else in the league, just very different way of going about their business. Like, if I could tell you that you have Cordy Glenn on a one-year rental where – like, if you cut him after next year, you are free and clean of the cap. It's like, goodbye. If he's terrible, goodbye. You start over. And if he plays well enough to merit a spot on your roster, well, you have a starting left tackle for $7.25 million in 2019 and $7.5 million in 2020. I think I'm A-okay with having that as my left tackle.
I agree. And I think, you know, they're not going to make many moves outside of their organization, like you said, but the guys who are moving on, you know, in years past, you look at Andrew Whitworth leaving and you think, oh, well, he's pretty good, man. I would really like to have someone to replace Andrew Whitworth, or someone like, you know, Kevin Zeitler last year, or when they lost Marvin Jones and Mohamed Sanu in the same offseason a couple of years ago. And it's like, oh, those guys are pretty good. That's actually going to hurt for them to leave. This year's crop of guys, it's not like they lost a ton from the team they had a year ago, where, you know, Andre Smith was someone who really struggled to stay healthy and play effective football. A.J. McCarron, you know, had some success in that year where the Bengals had a really dominant offensive line. That trade would have been nice, the one that they worked out with the Browns, ended up not happening, but all things considered, I don't think they're going to miss A.J. McCarron all that much. Jeremy Hill had kind of lost his way. Adam Jones had taken a step backwards. Kevin Minter was someone they imported who hadn't worked out. I mean, they really only added talent to this team versus the guys who were playing meaningful roles last year.
Yeah, we talk about the value of an offseason for a player, a full offseason, and typically NFL players exhibit their greatest growth between their first and second seasons in the league. Now, that's not universal, but on average, that tends to be the year that we see these quantum leaps, right? I mean, it happens almost every single season. I think, you know, Jared Goff is a great example last year, and Carson Wentz, for that matter. I think that the Bengals have two players that are primed to make just a massive leap this year, and early on, you know, obviously, Joe Mixon, second round pick last year, had plenty of opportunities, right? But there was just never an he never got going. And he, whether you want a bad offensive line, whether it's whatever the excuse is, I don't know. But still, I think he's a player that has a chance to make a massive leap. Now, this is not a first to second year leap, but a second to third year leap. I think that William Jackson, their cornerback, who was drafted out of Houston 2 years ago, has been slowed down by injuries. But he's a really, really good, a really talented player. Checks a lot of the boxes for a cornerback. Good size, great speed, obviously, at the combine a couple years back, I should say. I think Jackson could really make a major impact on this defense in 2018.
Yeah, and I think Marvin Lewis has a long track record of developing young cornerbacks into useful players, and Terrell Austin has a great track record coming from Detroit as well. So I feel like there's a very solid defensive coaching staff there. Now, we both seem pretty high on the Bengals.
Yeah, I think I'm okay with it.
What grade do you have for them?
I'd give them a B+. You know, like, it's just like, and not a lot of flash, not a lot of sizzle, but I mean, I am not going to say the goal for the Bengals is to, like, just get back to the playoffs, but I'm just telling you, Bill, and I think you know this as well, like, if they get back to like 8, 9, 10 wins this season, like, I don't think the ownership group is going to be, you know, like, pounding its feet. Yes, of course you want to make the playoffs, right? But after what happened last year, like, we know it was a bizarre offseason when Marvin Lewis went from, like, likely out until signing a new deal. So yeah. I think that for the Bengals, like, you know, getting back on track is the first step here.
Yeah, and I think that they've done what they needed to do to get back on track. So I'm with you. B+ as well. I think a very solid offseason for them. Cleveland Browns, I think a offseason that could go in a lot of different directions. Of course, Sashi Brown fired before the end of the year. John Dorsey comes in. They import Todd Haley as well. And then a lot of changes, a lot of investments, none more so then taking Baker Mayfield with the first overall pick, and then adding Denzel Ward with the fourth overall selection. Now, of course, we still can't grade these players. It's still way too early to say how they're going to turn out. But in terms of their process and in terms of what they did to help those players, what do you think about the Browns offseason?
Lot to unpackage here, Bill, and I probably am going to, I'm probably going to speak out of both sides of my mouth a little bit right here. Because there are some moves in the Browns made that I really agree with, and there are some moves that I would say, like, I think they overpaid, but the question is, when you, like, let me start here.
Okay.
I think there was organizational directive from the highest level to get this team on, like, to make this team relevant again. Like, I don't think that John Dorsey got this job, and I don't think that Jimmy Haslam, I shouldn't say that Jimmy Haslam was telling them this directly. I'm not trying to report anything here, but I don't think that when John Dorsey took this job, Jimmy Haslam said, you know something, like, this is another year for us to kind of, you know, let's take the 30, let's be spectators in free agency, because we're not going to be excellent this year, so let's just stay away and just, you know, just let everybody else go out there and spend the big bucks. Like, I think that that Jimmy Haslam is sick of losing, and I think he probably said to John Dorsey, you're coming here, and if you want to spend big, you have my blessing. Mm-hmm. This is the second time that John Dorsey has been an NFL GM. The first time he took over a Chiefs roster that was better than the Browns roster that he inherited and had a very, very well-managed and clean cap. Mm-hmm. He right away traded for Alex Smith and I believe gave him a new deal.
Yep.
He signed, amongst other players, he retained Dwayne Bowe. He retained Brandon Albert. I believe it was Bowe got the long-term deal and maybe Albert got the franchise tag.
Yep, I think it was 5 years and $55 million for Dwayne Bowe.
5 years, $55 million for Dwayne Bowe. Now, there's probably a Dwayne Bowe to the Brown show that's ready to be made somewhere there as well. But he signed Donnie Avery to like a 5 year, $32 million deal. I believe he signed a backup tight end, I think it was, took a 3 year, like $12 million deal. So my point is this, is that it was history repeating itself with John Dorsey, right? I mean, he was going to take the assets he had and make some use of them. Mm-hmm. Now, that being said, there are some of the moves that I'm thinking to myself. I love Jarvis Landry and how he plays the game in so many ways. But the slot receiver market has dictated in the NFL that you're not, I mean, like, we've seen it has not developed anywhere close to the way that, you know, quote unquote perimeter receivers have. Mm-hmm. And you can tell me that Jarvis Landry has more ability than most slot receivers, and I tell you, you're right. But $15.1 million per season for a guy that I think averaged like 8.8 yards per catch last year.
Right.
I love Jarvis Landry, but that was a robust contract for him. TJ Carey, the defensive back from Oakland, a robust contract for him. Chris Hubbard, the reserve tackle from Pittsburgh, who might be a starter in Cleveland, robust contract for him. Carlos Hyde, robust contract for him. So a lot of that stuff, a lot of those moves, I think, you know, you're spending big, maybe they turn out better than I expect them to, but a lot of money spent on guys that I'm not sure you're going to get the same bang for your buck you'd want.
Yeah, and I wonder if there's a thing where they have to pay a premium for guys just because they're the Browns, and they're 1-31 over the past 2 years, and if you're Jarvis Landry, well, he was traded there, but maybe Jarvis Landry doesn't want to sign an extension if they're not paying him like he's, you know, Allen Robinson or Sammy Watkins, and I don't know if that makes the deals good. I don't think it does, but I think maybe, you know, it does kind of explain that they've had to pay a premium for guys who, you know, are good, you know, average, maybe a little better than average in some case, NFL players who, you know, you're going to have to pay a premium to get them to come and want to play in Cleveland.
Now, Bill, the other thing I would say is, and I'm going to turn back to both John Dorsey and also Dave Gettleman to make this point. Mm-hmm. The NFL has to, like, if you're a head coach or a GM, there's like three of them in the NFL that I think can truly execute their vision of roster building how they want to. Because the reality is, like, the leash is so ridiculously short. And I'm sure there was more to it beyond just seasons that didn't finish how the team wanted them to. But think about this. Dave Gettleman was the general manager of a team that went 15-1 and was the favorite in most people's eyes going into the Super Bowl. Mm-hmm. And a year and a half later, whatever it was, fired. Yeah. John Dorsey helped the Chiefs make it to the playoffs, I believe, in consecutive seasons. Fired last June. Like, you can't tell me that if you're an NFL GM or head coach, you have to understand, like, you are making moves that even if you know there's a chance they won't necessarily work great over the long haul, you have to do it in the short term to secure yourself. It's like how these baseball contracts work. You think people, like, do you think the Angels thought that Albert Pujols was going to be worth $27.5 million in his age 38 or 39 season, right? Mm-hmm. David Price to the Red Sox, $32 million. Give me a break. Smart baseball people knew that wasn't probably going to be the best spending of $30-plus million in a season, but in order to secure those players, you got to pay them huge numbers for the years 30, 31, 32 seasons. So the Browns are kind of doing the same thing. Like, we got to pay these guys a ton of money up front in order to get them to stick around for the long haul.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, I can't really fault them for it. You know, I think it's, you know, I'm an analytically inclined person. I didn't always agree with what Sashi Brown did, but I think overall, I mean, there were some logical moves. There were some moves that I would not have made myself. But at the end of the day, like, 1-31 is 1-31, no matter how many assets you've accumulated. And I think, you know, they're in great draft position with what they've accomplished this year, and they got a lot of players who should help them. But, like, you gotta win. At some point, you have to at least show signs you are going to win. I think if the Browns had gone 5-11 last year, I mean, seen a couple guys break through who were young, talented players, who would have said, okay, well, you know, they're taking steps in the right direction. And they had not been taking steps in the right direction. So I can't fault them for investing in those guys. I can't fault them for paying Jarvis Landry that much money. And hopefully it does work out and help Baker Mayfield. Hopefully Tyrod Taylor plays a huge role in it and is very valuable and then gets traded for, you know, a useful draft pick halfway through the season, or they franchise him and trade him after the year. I don't know. But yeah, there's you know, certainly a point where they have to start investing in talent. And I think I can't fault them for a lot of the moves they made, even if I do think in a lot of cases they did overpay for some of the players they brought in.
So I'll give them a B for the simple fact that, like, I mean, and again, they have the most room to go upwards, but I think there's a chance they have the league's largest leap in terms of wins added this year, right? Yeah. Like, I think they could have a 5-win leap. But the grade would have been higher if, like you told me again, to break those, just like we're doing with every other team, like individually breaking them down. Like, do I love the idea of TJ Carey being an $8 million a year defensive back? The answer is no. Do I like the idea of bypassing Bradley Chubb at pick 4? I don't. Mm-hmm. Even with Myles Garrett and Emmanuel Ogba. Do I like the idea of some of the other? No, I don't. I don't love that. But at the same time, I do like that this team will actually be NFL competent on Sunday from a roster standpoint. And I think also, like, we're going to learn a lot about Hugh Jackson this year, Bill. I think that's a fair thing to say.
Oh, for sure. And I think, you know, even if you think he won that power struggle with Sashi Brown, and you think he deserved more than the talent level he had to work with over the past couple of years, I mean, a lot of guys have come into this roster who have had some success elsewhere. Guys like Kevin Zeitler, guys like Jarvis Landry now, and we're going to have to see if they improve under Hugh Jackson's stewardship as opposed to declining when it comes to being in Cleveland. I agree with you. I think a B is the logical move there. I will say a team on the opposite side of the spectrum from the Browns, the Pittsburgh Steelers, who have a core that they're pretty happy with and maybe some minor additions here and there. Are you happy with them signing Morgan Burnett and then drafting Terrell Edmonds in the first round to help out that secondary?
Right. So I forget, and I should know this, but I know John Wooden popularized it. I believe he did. I'm not sure if he was the original thought, if this was his thought originally, but what's like, don't confuse activity with achievement, right?
Yeah.
And so the vice versa, right? Like, a pretty quiet offseason for the Steelers. Does that mean it was a bad offseason for the Steelers?
No.
No, the answer is no. Like, the biggest, like, honestly, most of the Steelers offseason has been about, like, drama, perceived or real, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, like, Big Ben retiring and then, you know, or, you know, threatening retirement and then not, and then, you know, getting frustrated over the team using a third round pick on Mason Rudolph. Like, I mean, Ben, you have missed a couple of games here or there, but that's a different story. I'm largely okay with the Pittsburghs. I'm okay with what they did this offseason. Like, I didn't think they had a bunch of major offseason needs. Mm-hmm. I'm still concerned. We understand that this year we will not see Ryan Shazier on the field.
Right.
We hope, we pray that he will one day be back on an NFL field, but we understand that's, you know, perhaps a long shot. They needed the quarterback on the defense. They really did. And that's one of those things that, like, it's hard to quantify, but you kind of know it when you see it.
Sure.
And just, like, when things are moving fast on defense, somebody who can tell players at all levels of the field, like, you need to be there, you need to be there, and here's what you're doing, right? I mean, that's a hard thing to do. So I don't know that they adequately found their quarterback of their defense. But other than that, like, the offense was pretty much fine. Like, it was really, really good. Like, if anything, like, they just ideally get a long-term deal done with Le'Veon Bell, and I'm saying to myself, like, yep, the offense has addressed most of its needs.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, we'll see what happens with Le'Veon Bell. I think that's still up in the air, of course, but I don't fault them. I mean, Chris Hubbard was going to leave. He was going to get starting caliber money from someone and did from the Browns. Then the Steelers can't really afford to pay him at this point. I mean, they have their offensive line set. They have a very good offensive line. Martavis Bryant, the someone who they wanted to trade last year, whose role was usurped by Juju Smith-Schuster, who's going to be obviously starting for them. And they drafted James Washington, and they got a third-round pick, I believe, from the Raiders from Martavis Bryant. That's a pretty good return for a guy with 1 year left in his deal who wasn't going to be signing here in the long term. You swap out Mike Mitchell, you bring in Morgan Burnett. And pretty logical move. I can't really fault him for any of that. I mean, you're looking at like minor things here. You're looking at maybe they add a backup running back. Besides James Conner, who can catch the football if Le'Veon Bell gets hurt. Maybe I'm a little surprised they haven't gone out and re-signed Lawrence Timmons, who left, you know, last year wasn't necessarily the cleanest breakup, but, you know, someone to fill in and give them, like you said, maybe a quarterback for the defense, given that they have John Bostic and Vince Williams right currently as they're starting inside linebackers right now. But, I mean, you're looking at things where this is the Steelers. They're going to be the Steelers next year, and that's a pretty good thing to be.
Yeah, there are a lot worse places to be as an organization than, like, us talent saying, like, hey, you know, like, they didn't do a whole lot, but I probably think they'll win somewhere between 10 and 12 games next
year. Yeah, exactly. So I gave them a B+. I thought it was very solid. I thought they addressed the few needs they could have hit pretty well.
Yep, I'll go with the B+ as well. I think it's a smart sort of overall tactical approach by the Steelers, which, like, that's how they are. Like, you don't earn this reputation over the course of 50 years without good reason.
Yeah, I give them the benefit of the doubt more so than I do other teams. And I think you need to give us the benefit of the doubt. We're going to go to break, but we're going to come back with more Bill Barnwell Show here in a moment. But first, guys, the NFL season's coming up. We're talking about it with the NFC last week, the AFC this week. There's a lot of games coming up that might be interesting. Teams that might not have seemed that promising, your Bears, for example, might not have been that desperate to get tickets for them this time last year. Well, suddenly they look like a team you might want to check out if they're on the road and playing your favorite team. Or if you're in Chicago, you might want to check out the Bears. I don't know. I don't know any people in Chicago. But if I did, I would suggest they should get tickets at SeatGeek, because SeatGeek gets tickets from all over the web. They use their deal score technology to rate the tickets from 0 to 99. You're not going to believe this. 99 is pretty good. 0, I'm not going to lie, 0 is pretty bad. Don't buy the 0 tickets, but use deal score technology to know you're getting a 99 deal when you use SeatGeek. And even better than just getting scores, just getting tickets aggregated from all over the web, you can get $20 back when you make your first purchase on SeatGeek today. Go to the app, enter my promo code, which is Barnwell, B-A-R-N-W-E-L-L, and you'll get $20 back when you make that purchase on SeatGeek. So whether your ticket is $20, whether it's $2,000, whether it's $2 million, I would say don't spend $2 million on tickets unless you are, I can't imagine what you would spend $2 million on tickets for, but anything below $2 million, anything more than a dollar, get $20 back when you use my promo code Barnwell at SeatGeek today. Back here on the Bill Barnwell Show, I'm still Bill Barnwell of ESPN, still joined here by Field Yates, also of ESPN. We are grading the AFC offseason, so we covered the AFC North, a very positive, I feel like, grading period. I wonder if it's going to be the same thing for the AFC South. We may have some disagreement here. I'm a little skeptical of some of these teams. And let's start with the Houston Texans, who I think it's unfair to sort of look at their draft and blame them just because those picks were traded away last year. I don't know if I can really fault them for those trades, given that they did get Deshaun Watson, worked out pretty well. But in terms of the moves they did make this offseason, in signing Aaron Colvin, signing Tyrann Mathieu, improving that secondary, are you pleased with what they did?
Yeah, I think I'm largely pleased where the secondary is, Bill. And I'm not sure there's a team whose health and the return to health will impact its outlook more than the Texans, right?
Yeah,
like, it's not just Deshaun Watson. It is also, you know, J.J. Watt, for example, Whitney Mercilus, for example. And on the offensive line, there are some moving pieces that need to, like, get healthy again. So, like, this team is going to be better just by showing up this year. I don't hate the value, for Tyrann Mathieu or Aaron Colvin. Like, cornerbacks are going to be expensive. If you don't understand that now, you're going to figure it out very soon.
Right.
Mathieu is a player that I know was, sort of like, it depended on who you asked inside the NFL about his value right now, right? Like, not the player he was previously, otherwise he wouldn't have been cut in the first place. But on a 1 year deal, like, it's hard for me to dislike too many 1 year deals on principle.
Right.
Now, where I think I probably would love to have seen more from the Texans this offseason is fortifying the offensive line.
Yep.
I just don't know, like, when their major move in the offensive line this year was signing Zach Fulton, another former Chief offensive lineman, to a deal where I think it's around $7 million per season. Fulton's an okay player, not a great player. So maybe some versatility, but still, like, to me, question marks at left tackle, still some question marks, maybe on both tackle spots, to be honest, for you, in the Houston Texans offense. And I know it sounds weird, but playing for a really, really I would say athletic, mobile quarterback can actually be more difficult for offensive linemen than playing for a sort of statue type quarterback. And you'd say, like, why? Like, they should in theory take fewer sacks because the quarterback can avoid them. Well, you know, remember, like, offensive linemen don't practice pass sets where, you know, they kick step three times, right or left, and the next thing you know, they're, like, moving across the pocket because the quarterback is pirouetted away from pressure, right? That's instincts and reaction skills. So playing offensive tackle for a guy like Deshaun Watson, and he's an amazing player, I'm not saying that, but it's a very unique skill that you have to be able to sort of cultivate and hone. So the fact that they have two question marks at offensive tackle worries me.
Yeah, me too. And you're 100% right. I mean, it's, you want to know where your quarterback's going to be if you're playing offensive tackle, just so you know where to set and, you know, how deep you want to let a defensive end come past you. I mean, all those things make logical sense. Of course, you're willing to trade that if you have a guy who's going to make brilliant things happen, like a Russell Wilson or a Deshaun Watson, but you're right. It's going to be tougher. And so,
Dwayne Brown deserves a raise, right? Like, goes from playing for, you know, with Deshaun Watson to Russell Wilson. He's certainly seen them both, man.
He sure has. And he's also seen the opposite. He's seen Tom Savage back there as well. So he's seen pretty much the most statuesque passer in the game. So, I mean, I'm intrigued to see what happens with the Houston offense. They were so incredible last year with Sean Watson in the lineup. And you kind of figure, okay, well, there might be a little bit of a, you know, a recovery time. He tore his ACL in midseason. He might not be 100% to start the year. But I would have liked to have seen more offensive line help. It is going to be tough, but I think you want to throw bodies at that. You want to hope you stumble onto an athletic tackle who's going to make plays for you, who's going to be someone who can grow with Deshaun Watson. And they had some salary cap concerns. They spent heavily over the past couple of years, gave out big contracts to guys who deserved them, to be fair, like DeAndre Hopkins. But I, you know, as much as they added to the secondary, and I think it makes sense to add secondary help, would have liked to have seen some of that money go to the offensive line. So I gave them a C+. And granted, draft picks would help, and next year they're going to be able to draft some offensive linemen, but I would have liked to have seen maybe Aaron Colvin's money go to an offensive lineman if possible.
Yeah, I like that. I think I agree with a lot of what you said there, Bill. I'll go with the C+ as well. They kind of remind me of the Carolina Panthers from a cap construction standpoint in this regard. They've got a lot of star players. They're going to make a lot of money and take up a big chunk of their cap each year, and they're going to have to prove that, like, fungibility in the NFL is something that teams can navigate, right? Like, find the guys that aren't quite, even if they're really good players, they're not quite worth that top-tier money. And, you know, and you replace a player who, you know, with someone who provides 80% of the value at 40% of the price.
Right. Indianapolis Colts, you mentioned a little bit earlier, a team that kind of knows they're not really especially good right now, still sort of waiting to see what happens with Andrew Luck, replaced their head coach this year. Obviously, it looked like it was going to be Josh McDaniels, and then it wasn't, but getting past the McDaniels thing, what do you think of their offseason in terms of the player personnel moving in and out?
Yeah, again, I'm a fan of a team that is honest with itself about where it's at, right? Like, I think the Colts, they certainly had the financial resources to go out there and sign players for massive money. Yep. Like, if they wanted to, Bill, they probably could have made Andrew Norwell the highest paid guard in league history, even higher, you know, more money than he made from the Jacksonville Jaguars. And people would have said, A, they needed him, and B, like, yeah, smart, like, really good player, you're adding him, right? You got to help Andrew Luck. They resisted that temptation, okay? They did so across the board. Like, who was their major free agent addition this year? Like, DeNico Autry? Like, honestly, like, do we, I'm sure I'm overlooking somebody, but, like, between Autry and they obviously signed Ryan Grant after his deal that went awry with the Baltimore Ravens, and
maybe Eric Ebron?
Eric Ebron probably is really their hallmark free agency addition. But, you know, still, like, all these players that, like, are on fairly, like, low risk moves, you know, they basically eschewed free agency when they had all the money to spend. They are setting themselves up for 2019 and beyond. Now, maybe that's because they understand that, like, even if Andrew Luck is healthy this year, the team is not going to be good enough for it to compete for the playoffs. I just happen to like the idea of how they've approached this offseason. The process has been very sound by GM Chris Ballard, and that extends to the draft as well. I love the move to acquire those three extra second-round picks that they made in the deal with the New York Jets.
And you like that, then on top of that, the guy they drafted at 6 was Quentin Nelson, who might have been the guy they would have taken at 3.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, he would have gone 3rd, or at least you would have made the case for him. Now, I understand some people, you know, basically, if you're going to draft a guy third or sixth at guard, like, you know, there are some people in the NFL that feel like that player has to become Larry Allen for it to sort of justify the pick. Mm-hmm. And Larry Allen, like, they don't just, you know, like, not a dime a dozen, right? One of my favorite, like, not that I, like, you know, can tell you that I just have spent, like, hours and hours and hours, like, studying every single NFL offensive guard. But one of those guards, it was fun to watch because he would, like, you know, you'd be like, that's a man amongst boys, right?
Yes, for sure.
That being said, Nelson probably could have been a pick at three for them, and they end up getting Nelson plus two extra second-round picks this year, one of which they traded, plus a second-round pick next year. So I liked the approach by Indy all across the board.
Yeah, and I think you kind of have to do that when you have a team that when Ballard inherited it, really they hadn't had many successful draft picks. So you had that, you know, a few top-level guys where you have Luck and T.Y. Hilton. Well, those are two pretty good players to start with, but a lot of depth issues, a lot of draft picks who hadn't panned out, some free agents who hadn't worked out. They need, you know, they not only need your Quentin Nelsons, you need your Braden Smiths, you need your Darius Leonards, guys who are going to be starters and who are going to be young, talented starters who are going to grow with you and grow with Andrew Luck. So I think you need to get as many of those first and second round picks as possible. So I can't fault them for trading down, even if maybe they get Bradley Chubb with three and he turns into a superstar. I think that, you know, you need starters at this point if you're the Indianapolis Colts. You can't just rely on Andrew Luck to carry you. And we saw what happened where Andrew Luck didn't have the help and eventually ended up costing him at least a full season of health.
You know, Bill, things could change, and certainly we could have an update on Andrew Luck at any moment right now. But honestly, like, you know, they might be my pick for the number one pick in the draft for 2019, unless Andrew Luck is fully healthy for the entire season.
Right. I will say, we saw a photo of Andrew Luck recently where he looked, I would say, yoked. He looks enormous.
Fair. I would say that, like, listen, not someone who can relate to that necessarily myself. But as someone who did see that as well on Twitter, like, I was like, is Andrew Luck now playing linebacker for the Colts? He is huge.
He is enormous. So I gave them a B+. I felt like it was a very solid offseason. Like you said, you know where they are. And I think that this isn't a team that's going to go 9-7 next year, but a team that I think is in the right place heading forward.
Yeah, A- for me. I think maybe even higher than that. Like, because I think again, you have a plan. Whatever that plan is, stick to it. And they did that from start to finish.
So the Jacksonville Jaguars, a team that really stuck with their plan for years, and we saw it pay off last year. We saw them emerge as a truly dominant defense, and a team that was able to run the football reasonably well, not maybe as well as they would have hoped, but a team that was able to, you know, obviously play their way into the playoffs. They were competitive against the Patriots. Honestly, it looked like they were going to win for most of the AFC Championship game, and well, they kind of furthered it this offseason, but they went out and they signed Andrew Norwell to an enormous deal, and added maybe the best run-blocking guard or one of the best run-blocking guards in all of football to an offensive line that wants to run the football. So seems to make sense, no?
I mean, listen, like, they have an identity. Give them that much, right?
Yes,
like,
for sure.
They know what they are, what they want to be, and they are just going to double, triple, quadruple down on it. That being said, Bill, and let's start by saying this. For the first time in a long time, as you alluded to, like, they're going to have difficult decisions on their roster because they have enough talent now where guys are going to either want contracts or you've got so many guys on expensive contracts that somebody has to go.
Right.
Now, again, if I told you entering the offseason that they would draft a defensive tackle in the first round when they have an embarrassment of riches along the defensive line.
They should actually be embarrassed, to be honest with you. They should be ashamed of how much defensive
line. Right,
it's
crazy. You know, moreover, a defensive tackle who was a one-year starter, had okay production, like, definitely needs a lot of work. Maybe that's the reason why they drafted him, hoping that he could develop in a few years.
Sure.
But, you know, like, Jacksonville knows what they are, what they want to be. And on the guard front, like, if I'm not mistaken, last year, like, you know, the numbers, and again, I think it's really, really difficult to quantify offensive line play, but
for sure,
the naked eye told me that was a pretty solid offensive line. I didn't look at it as one that was deficient. And in the postseason, when they, of course, beat the Buffalo Bills, but really the two games that mattered that I think people were most impressed by were the smothering of the Steelers, at least offensively, when they did not allow the team that led the NFL in sacks in Pittsburgh to sack Blake Bortles, and then they ran all over the Patriots in the AFC Championship game early. Like, I saw a pretty dominant offensive line.
Mm-hmm.
So I was surprised by the Andrew Norwell deal. And they have also, you know, they committed themselves to Blake Bortles in for at least one more year, Bill.
Yep.
But really, if you look at the contract, like, I think you're probably committing, and the way they've addressed the quarterback this offseason, like, probably two more years of Blake Bortles. And right. I think maybe your feelings on the offseason is somewhat defined by how you feel about Blake Bortles as a player.
Right. I think that's fair, because I think it's not like evaluating Josh Allen, where we don't know what Josh Allen is yet necessarily. Maybe we don't know what Blake Bortles is. Maybe those last two games where he looked pretty good against the Steelers and the Patriots mean more than that game against the Bills where he looked hopeless, I might say. He looked really bad for most of that game against the Bills.
Yeah.
At the very least, you can say he's inconsistent. Even if this was a good season for him overall, or a better season than he had in 2016, he was still inconsistent in 2017 from month to month. And I think it's going to help if they can run the ball better than they did a year ago. And I think obviously when they ran the ball effectively in those games, it did make Bortles look better by all means. But I'm not even that concerned about Norwell. I think it's maybe an overpay, but it's still a good player. I think it's fair to say Andrew Norwell's going to be a good guard. But you're committing to Blake Bortles when you did not really have to, when they could have, I believe, stuck him with the franchise tag and gone year to year and see, okay, is this guy actually going to keep improving? And I think on top of that, the moves they made at wide receiver, I'm a little skeptical of. I mean, Marquise Lee is a solid wide receiver, but Dante Moncrief is someone where, you know, as someone who covers fantasy football in addition to real football, he's been a perennial breakout candidate who has he ever really actually broken out?
I would say no. And at some point, like, we don't have time to waste time anymore with players to the extent that, like, maybe it just won't happen with Dante Moncrief. Like, maybe he just won't break out. Now, I don't want that to. Like, we like to see every player succeed, right? Like, that's just the nature of how this business works. At the same time, like, you know, I'm not counting on Dante Moncrief, you know, becoming the standout player, but he gets $11 million, whatever it was, in free agency. So there were some interesting decisions at wide receiver, especially, you know, when you juxtapose it against not matching or not signing Allen Robinson, who, of course, now is a Chicago Bear. So, I give credit to the Colts, I'm sorry, to the Jaguars for sort of, like, identifying what they are and sticking to it. I just, you know, I still think some of these moves I'm having to talk myself into, as opposed to being able to tell people why these teams made these moves.
Yeah, and I thought their last offseason, I believe I checked on ESPN.com, I gave it a B+, thought it was very solid. It worked out better than I could have hoped for, I have to admit. I didn't think Calais Campbell was going to be a defensive player of the year candidate. Didn't think that, you know, they were going to have the best cornerback situation in football. Thought they'd be pretty good, but I'm not as high on this one. I'm giving them a C-, and I think it's not, you know, it's not Norwell. It's committing another year to Bortles, and it's giving Moncrief nearly $10 million fully guaranteed on a one-year deal. Where even if he does break out, then what do you do next year?
Yeah, I understand. I totally get where you're coming from here. I'll go with the C for the Jacksonville Jaguars. And if Blake Bortles proves us both wrong, like, that team might be competing for the Super Bowl next year.
Oh, if Blake Bortles is good, I think they can be the best team in the AFC. I think the defense is going to be great again. But it's, man, you're making a commitment to Blake Bortles, and I don't know. I remember some of those bad Blake Bortles games even last year, and we'll see. You know, I think he played well enough in those last two games to get at least another year as the starter there. Tennessee, a team that is in change, certainly. They fired Mike Mularkey, brought in Mike Vrabel. They are clearly going with a Patriots-esque approach, and that extends to signing ex-Patriots.
Yeah, I would say so, Bill. And I think when you go into the offseason, like, I had a hard time finding a player whose contract, in my opinion, was onerous on the Titans roster, right? Yeah. Like, you're stuck with that player, or it's like, I don't know if that guy's worth that amount of money. There really wasn't a guy that fit that bill for me in Tennessee going into this offseason. That's important to note because, A, it's a reflection of the administration, the regime, and John Robinson, their GM, has been there for a few years now. Mm-hmm. And also, it means you have some flexibility, right? Like, it's not as if your cap constraints are as significant as probably others around the NFL.
Right.
You know, I think it's a lot of money for Deion Lewis. It's a lot of money for Malcolm Butler. It's just a fact, right? I mean, running back is probably one where, Bill, you and I might be on a different side of the equation than some others. Where it's like, you know, I'm not sure any running back that is not a clear-cut starter is worth $5.5 million per season. Like, I think I would just start there with Deion Lewis, who I love as a player. I mean, is that fair? Like, I'm sure they overpaid. It was a lot of money. It's a lot of money, period.
I just think the thing is, it's this for me. Look at the Patriots over the last 15 years, where John Robinson comes from, where Mike Vrabel comes from, where clearly they want to emulate the Patriots. I'll tell you, that's a pretty smart team to emulate. Yeah. I wouldn't blame them for that. You know, how often do the Patriots go into free agency and say, we got to get a running back from someone else and pay them $5 million a year because we can't develop that guy on our own? I don't think it's happened once since maybe Antoine Smith, you know, at the very beginning of the Belichick era. They are a team that is, you know, they've signed James White, they've signed Shane Vereen to extensions.
Dillon got one extension.
Dillon got that extension, yep. And, I mean, they drafted Lawrence Maroney in the first round. They drafted Sonny Michel in the first round. But overall, you look at the guys who will play for them. It's been mid-round picks. It's been guys on very cheap deals. They went out and signed Deion Lewis for nothing and kept him around for a couple of years at a very low cost. And when he got expensive, they said, okay, well, Deion Lewis, you're a good player, but it's time for you to move on. And I'm not saying Deion Lewis is not worth the money. I'm not saying he's not a good player, but it surprises me when people leave New England and then do things that the Patriots themselves don't seem to do.
Yeah, which is definitely interesting. And we applaud people for, like, leaving sort of, like, you know, flying the nest and still, like, you know, like, sort of developing their own way of doing business. But sort of interesting. And with Malcolm Butler, like, Bill, just telling you, it's a player that other teams around the NFL were concerned with paying. Which is the truth.
Were you surprised that he did not have to get a one-year deal after the Super Bowl?
No, but I think it was closer to happening than maybe we realize now, is what I would say.
Okay.
You know, sometimes it only takes one, right? So one suitor is enough to get the job done. But, you know, I think that a lot of people around the NFL, again, it would not have surprised me if he ended up on a one-year deal. At the same time, like, I think there are still people that think that the deal, even if he, like, it's going to take a lot for him to justify that contract. He can be a very good player.
Yep.
He was not that last year, but he can be that going forward, and that right there will make the deal worthwhile.
Mm-hmm. And I think you look at the draft where you drafted two guys, you'd figure Mike Vrabel would want to go after, and Rashawn Evans at 22, and then they traded up for Harold Landry.
Yeah.
At 41. I believe also the Rashawn Evans was a trade where
it was indeed. Yep. In both cases, they leapt in front of the Patriots, I think on both cases, right? Which makes you think they thought maybe the Patriots were preparing to make a pick on those players.
It's certainly possible. And Patriots could have justified taking both those guys. And I think the thing that interests me is that, well, the Patriots, they do occasionally trade up. It's fair to say, but look at Bill Belichick's track record. The majority of the time he's trading down, he's adding extra picks. So I find it interesting that they're moving up and, you know, trading picks away for guys. And granted, they traded up for Jack Conklin a couple of years ago. It worked out very well for them. He was a very useful right tackle.
If I'm not mistaken, though, that came after the trade down, right?
Yes, it did.
So it's almost like, you know, it's again, in totality, you're probably looking at it as like, listen, we're willing to make this move down because we have an idea we're going back up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's interesting. So I'm intrigued to see if those moves work out, because they're operating in one way in a very Belichickian way, in another way almost at odds with what they've learned from New England.
Yep. Yep, and it's just an interesting offseason for them because of the fact that I think that people around league and maybe people who watch the watch Football Weekly, Bill, like you and I, are maybe more concerned than ever before that Marcus Mariota may not be a certainty as a superstar quarterback. And I'll be the first to admit that last year, around this time, I was predicting superstardom.
Mm-hmm. I'm confused, though. You watch the games? I don't understand the point, to be honest.
Right, that's
with
a good point. That's
other
a good
people,
point.
Sure.
Yes. Know, fine, yeah, but no, I watch like those 6 second vines. Do those still exist?
I wish they still existed. Man. Sadly, no. I agree with you. I think you can at least ask that question, you know, as opposed to a year ago where, you know, whether it's injuries, whether it's maybe the scheme didn't fit Marcus Mariota, but we'll see. I think you can at least ask that question. We're going to learn a lot about him this year. Maybe more so than any other quarterback besides, I would say maybe Mitch Trubisky. I feel like they're the two guys who I'm most intrigued by seeing how they develop this
year. Agreed. Very, very interesting year ahead for both of them.
Let's finish up with the AFC West. We got the...
How about a grade though? I'm going with a C plus for the Titans.
I'm sorry. I can't believe I didn't get the grade.
How about that?
That's why you are a host of the most successful football podcast on ESPN Fantasy Focus, and I am a host for the 17th
come on
ESPN.
We love having you on.
Oh, that's very nice of you to say. I'm slowly trying to reverse it so that I have everyone on my show, and then suddenly I'm the new host of Fantasy Focus.
Bang, done. Like that plan already.
I'm gonna give them a C. I feel like I have concerns about the moves they made. I don't dislike the players, but I just like the price. I don't know about trading up repeatedly in the draft, but we'll see. I think they've done overall a pretty good job over the past couple of years with the Robinson regime in Tennessee.
Yes.
AFC West, Broncos, they knew what they wanted to do. They had to improve at quarterback. The move they made was they signed Case Keenum, and then they had a trade down with the Bills in play, and then said, we're good. We're going to just draft the best pass rusher in the draft and Bradley Chubb. Both those moves seem fine to me, no?
Yeah, both of them seem fine to me. Just one last, not to circle back, but I love the hire. I love Mike Vrabel's ability to be a head coach going forward. I really do.
Okay.
Last thing on Tennessee. So going back to Denver, you're right. Like, sort of not standing pat, but I think the Broncos, you know, they obviously were considered a potential suitor for Kirk Cousins.
Mm-hmm.
But I think they probably got to the point where other people are as well. It's like that, you know, maybe possibly worth $27 million per season or whatever it was that he got. But like, we're still not entirely sure. And if you're not entirely sure, you probably shouldn't make that investment, period.
Right. Exactly.
You know, so, you know, the Broncos decided to go with a more comfortable route. And next thing you know, they're giving Case Keenum $18 million per season, but it's only 2 years, which is like, we're in like with you. Maybe we're not in love with you. Cause I think if you're in love with a player at quarterback, you probably give him a 4 year deal, right?
Right. But you know what? If they're in like with Case Keenum, that's still a better thing than being in like with Paxton Lynch or in like with Trevor Siemian.
Yes, it sure is. And again, like, you know, we talked earlier about, I think it's just important to have like avenues to finding a quarterback and frankly avenues to getting out from underneath a quarterback contract. And
yes.
Case Keenum, if he, you know, sort of reverts back to the player he was for much of the beginning of his career, that it's not like the Broncos have signed a lifetime contract with him. It's a 2 year deal, which means it's in effect a 1 year deal.
Yeah. And I can't fault them for it. I mean, I think he played well enough last year that if you give him the right infrastructure, and granted, he's not going to have the receivers he perhaps had in Minnesota, but you put him in an offense that's going to play to his strengths, and I think Bill Musgrave has been a very flexible offensive coordinator during his time in the NFL. I think you're going to be fine. I do want to see what happens with their running game. They moved on from C.J. Anderson. They drafted Royce Freeman in the third round. You figure he could be part of that rotation with Devontae Booker. The offensive line, they really invested in it last year, had some injuries. And I think there's talent there top to bottom, but you're going to have to see Garrett Bowles develop in his second year. And you're going to have Jared Veldheer, who came over from Arizona, be a player who is an upgrade at right tackle on the likes of Menelik Watson and Donald Stevenson. It's not out of the question, but I think if the offensive line plays as poorly as it did last year, I think Case Keenum is going to struggle, and I think any quarterback would struggle behind that line.
Yeah, and I wonder how much help we get from the backfield. You mentioned Royce Freeman, Devontae Booker likely challenging or likely competing for the starting job.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Devontae Booker is a player that I think has like kind of like a, I mean, not a huge ceiling there, right? And came into the league old and hasn't been a massive, for rookie standards, right? I think it's like 23 as a rookie, 24.
Like,
and then Royce Freeman had, I think, 947 touches or rushes over the past 4 years, a ridiculous number of carries. I think an NCAA record as well.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah, that's plenty.
Yeah, plenty. So, like, I don't know that you're going to get, like, a ton of big plays out of the backfield. I'd like to be proven wrong, but I'm keeping a close eye on that competition.
Yeah, I think you have to hope you get more than you did last year. And I think Devontae Booker is someone who, I mean, maybe the light will click on, but so far he has not been a very effective running back, 3.6 yards per carry over his two seasons in Denver. And I mean, I think overall, I'm okay with the moves elsewhere. The Aqib Talib thing was probably going to happen. You figure it's going to be an extension for Bradley Roby, who's going to be playing a bigger role. They went, you know, with their nickel package a good chunk of the time anyway. So I'm excited about Bradley Chubb and Von Miller. I think you can never add too many pass rushers, so I'm not going to fault them there. I give them a B. I think it's an upgraded quarterback, and then I think they're all positioned to maybe take a step forward this year.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'd say like B- for me.
Mm-hmm. The Chiefs, I think a much more aggressive offseason than I think people might have expected. Alex Smith trade, people saw that happening. They draft Patrick Mahomes, trade up for him. You figure he's going to be the guy. Thought the trade they got was reasonable. Kendall Fuller is a useful player, second round pick from Washington. But then they went out and spent a lot of money on Sammy Watkins and Anthony Hitchens.
They did,
guys,
yeah.
Who got really top level contracts for their respective positions. Are you happy with those moves if you're a Chiefs fan?
I think I'm happy only because the team was really close.
Mm-hmm.
Last year, and I think some people interpreted the trade of Alex Smith as though we are starting from scratch, essentially. Whereas I think what we learned is the Chiefs feel as though Patrick Mahomes is ready to be really good right away.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you'd probably say that when you draft a guy 10th overall, but still, like, after trading up from 25th pick, by the way, or whatever it was, or 27th pick, wherever it was they traded up for.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think that there's a very good chance the Chiefs are one of the most enjoyable offenses to watch this season. But on defense, they're going to be, like, you know, this analogy has been made many times, and I'm not sure who first made it, but kind of the Big 12 feel, right? Like, tons of points on offense, and maybe a defense that gives up 25, 30 points in a bunch of weeks this season.
Yeah, I mean, this was a team that had major cornerback woes last year, and then traded their best cornerback away in Marcus Peters, and didn't really, outside of signing Kendall Fuller, really address the position all that much. Granted, yeah, they did sign David Emerson, and you know, maybe he'll take a step forward, but this is a guy who's been, outside of 1 year with the Raiders, a replacement-level cornerback. And, I mean, Steven Nelson, maybe you hope he improves. Maybe Kendall Fuller is a useful slot cornerback from day one, and he's someone you can build off of. And getting Eric Berry back is going to help a lot for sure, but he's someone coming off of an Achilles injury. That right. doesn't, you know, you can't assume he's going to be the superstar he was before that injury.
Right.
So,
yeah.
You're hoping the pass rush is there, and maybe Justin Houston is healthier again this year. Maybe Dee Ford is the guy we saw a couple of years ago. Breland Speaks, that they drafted in the second round, is going to be part of the rotation there. But I'm skeptical. And Anthony Hitchens is a useful player, but he's someone who, you look at the numbers, and this isn't the whole story, but it's part of the story. The Cowboys were really bad without Sean Lee in the lineup, and even with Anthony Hitchens on the field. And, well, when they had Anthony Hitchens on the field and Sean Lee out, they were bad, and when Anthony Hitchens was on the bench, they weren't any different. There wasn't like a noticeable drop off. And Sean Lee's a great player. I just know that Anthony Hitchens is a real difference maker, and what they're paying him, he kind of needs to be.
Yeah, and he's going to add, here I'll say this, he will add a bunch of toughness and physicality, which is important for them this offseason. That much I know. But it's, you know, something to keep an eye on. Derek Johnson obviously departs, and you're going to have to find a way to, again, if Anthony Hitchens, he kind of needs to be your quarterback of that defense, is what I would say.
Yep, I agree. So in terms of their offense, Sammy Watkins, it's $16 million a year. Again, a guy who, you know, you've expected a lot out of. I kind of see him as like the Sam Bradford of wide receivers.
Yeah, well
at
said.
This point.
Yeah.
I mean, and you know, Sam Bradford can do pretty good if you get everything going right for him. And Sammy Watkins, I think, can be a useful player, but they're paying him like he's a guaranteed number one guy. And I just don't know that he has been that guy at any point during his career.
Right. It's tricky. I always remind people that, like, when you're in free agency, you pay for traits, not production, right? Like,
yep.
You pay for what a player can do, not what he has done.
Mm-hmm.
So for Sammy Watkins, like, what he can do is be an awesome player, right? Like, he's had some moments that have been brilliant in the NFL. However, inconsistency, frankly, I mean, some durability issues have plagued him so far. So, I'm okay with the contract if we know that Sammy Watkins is fully healthy and good to go coming into week one, and he's utilized in a way that I think can lead to open production. At the same time, I understand why people are a little bit concerned that he sort of set the wide receiver market this offseason with guys like Odell Beckham Jr. soon to get paid and others at the wide receiver spot that some would say, like, yeah, those are comparable, if not better players.
Yeah. So I gave them a C. If Watkins turns into a superstar, the guy who he looks like he could be part-time, I'm happy for them, but I just don't love the price tag for those two guys.
Yeah, I'd say B- would be my final pick for them.
All right, Los Angeles Chargers, very quiet offseason. Yeah. We didn't make many changes. The one thing is we just saw Hunter Henry tore his ACL. He's going to be done for the year. You figure they might go back and re-sign Antonio Gates or bring in another tight end, but otherwise it was really about their draft, and they signed Derwin James, they drafted Derwin James, who it sounds like you're a big fan of.
Yeah, I love Derwin James. I like the player going into the draft, and I love the value, obviously, at 17th overall. I mean, like, probably a pretty easy case for him as a top 10 prospect this year, and over the past few years, NFL teams have seen the rise of tight end and safety as perhaps one of the more notable roster trends. When you have a guy that can do a little bit of everything at either spot, it really changes the complexion of your offense or defense. I think Derwin James kind of fits that mold. And this is a big if, Jason Verrett stays healthy, like, you're talking about a potentially deep and talented secondary in Los Angeles. So they're going to be able to, and when you combine that with, you know, like, maybe the best pass rush in football, at least the best pass rushing duo. Like, yeah, a lot of the ingredients are there. Like, truthfully, like, maybe the most important move they made this offseason is signing Caleb Sturgis, the kicker, who I believe started last year with the Eagles before he made it,
hurt.
And yeah, he got hurt right away, and then Jake Elliott became their starter. So, they needed to stay, like, I think they were pretty much three field goals away last year from not only being in the playoffs, but, like, maybe hosting a first round game. Really, really good in the playoffs. So, if they can solidify their special teams, like, they got a chance to be, like, you know, be one of the five, or, you know, maybe even one of the three best teams in the AFC, I think.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly on the table. There's a lot of Chargers fans who are guests on this podcast, and one of them who hosts the podcast, so I'm not going to disagree with you there one bit. I give them a B minus, not really, not like a negative grade, just they didn't do much. Like, they kind of held the fort, which is fine.
Yeah, I'll go with B plus. Interesting offseason, a lot of status quo, but it's not a bad thing for a team that I think is good.
Right. I think most of the work they had to do was done in the years past. Let's finish up with the Oakland Raiders, who made a lot of changes.
Yeah, Bill, so confusing. So confusing. So many changes in terms of players coming out, coming in, and players going out. Mm-hmm. Let's just be honest. They got older and slower on offense. And on defense, I'm not sure they got decidedly better. And maybe you can make the case they got older as well on defense. And they have tons and tons and tons of roster needs on defense. The quarterback probably dictates, Derek Carr dictates where they end up next year more than anything else.
Right.
But I'm not so sure that a repeat of this year's success would not surprise me.
Yeah. Are you excited about Jordy Nelson?
No, to be honest. I mean, mm-hmm. I would have been more excited about Michael Crabtree still being there, is what I would say.
Interesting.
Is that a fair way to characterize it?
I think it's fair. It seems like there is a, you know, maybe it's too simple to make that John Gruden case where it's like, oh, he's just signing players he watched on TV or Thursday Night Football or he's heard of, and I don't want to make that case. He's much smarter than that, but I mean, there's a lot of investment in here on veterans, and maybe that'll work out, but I think it's, you know, history tells us you want to be getting younger players in a league that's getting younger and younger with each passing year.
Yep. Younger players, drafting, developing, like, I just think player development's there, right? Like, you kind of know what you have with Jordy Nelson, which last year was not a very productive player, Bill. Like, the reality was, when he wasn't playing with Aaron Rodgers, he was a non-factor.
Yeah.
And I understand, listen, playing with Aaron Rodgers is good for everybody, mm-hmm. but Jordy Nelson, I hope he has more left in the tank than I thought he did based off the last half of last season, but I'm nervous he might not.
Yeah, and then I'm in the draft, Colton Miller in the first round. It seems like there was a lot of question marks surrounding where he went at 15.
Yep. No, listen, it's a really confusing in some ways offseason for the Raiders. Like, you're right, you know, their tackle Colton Miller might not have been it. You know, he might have gone 25 if he had not gone to the Raiders. Mm-hmm. This offseason has a lot of moves that probably don't have middle ground. They either work out really well or they blow up right away. Colton Miller, you know, Martavis Bryant, Jordy Nelson, Doug Martin. Like, mm-hmm. we'll see with the Raiders, what I would say.
Yeah, I think that's fair. What grade would you give them, though, to finish up here?
I think I have to go D. I think I have to match them with the
D.
Dolphins. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I would say C-. Maybe I'm a little more hopeful. But I you're kind of talking me into it, though. I have to admit, there's Tahir Whitehead I like. You know, I'm trying to pick Derek guys here or there. Where I'm like, oh, I can see that working out. Sharice Wright, you know, is okay. Maybe a little underrated, but it's pretty bleak there. And for a team that was so exciting this time last year.
Yeah.
Fields, we've made it through the entire AFC. We did it.
That was fun, Bill. Had a great time.
I am always happy to have you on Field. And of course, people know you because you are ubiquitous across the ESPN properties, as you should be. But just in case people don't know, where can they check you out?
Best, I always say, like, the best place to do it is just follow me on Twitter at FieldYates, and I will do my best to, distribute all my content as much as I can there.
And occasionally people yell at you.
Sometimes. It's okay. It's part of the gig. I like it.
You like it?
Yeah.
I'm excited. I feel like you're challenging people to yell at you now.
Embrace it.
Embrace debate. Field Yates, that's his quote. That's what he came up with. Field, thank you so much.
Thanks, Bill.
All right. Thanks so much to Field Yates for hopping on the show today. Always happy to have a first-time guest on. Hope you enjoyed those off-season grades. More audio content coming next week.